The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123, or email to cooley@admworld.com.
Welcome to the Closing Market Report. It's September the 24th, 2007. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing in Normal, Illinois. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, Senate Ag Chairman Tom Harkin has scheduled farm bill markup for next week. The House and Senate Ag leadership have agreed not to seek a general extension of the 2002 Farm Bill when it expires this coming Sunday. And a bipartisan group of Southern senators has asked the U.S. Trade Representative to reject cotton cuts in the WTO ag subsidy debates. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in the half hour. And don't forget, at the bottom of the hour, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast. And then stay with us all the way through the 3 o'clock central time frame. All this week, we've expanded the closing market report to an hour. You're in harvest mode, and we've decided to take advantage of that just a bit. Today, between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, we'll take up the new Dow AgriSciences Monsanto SmartStax GMO agreement, talk about Herculex BT and 2,4-D tolerant crops as well. Ben Kaler from Dow will join us and take your calls in the second half hour of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Taking a look now at the numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Monday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit at $8.77¾ were 3¾ higher. March futures at $8.83¼, up 5¾, and the May settled 15 higher at $7.82½. December corn futures $3.73½, down 3. The March at 3 lower at $3.89, and the May contract down 2¾ at $3.98½. And December futures at $4.16¾ were down 4½ cents for the day. November soybeans, $9.78¾, down 1¼. January futures unchanged at $9.94½. And the March contract, $10.02¾, up 1/4. November of next year settled at $9.41½. They were down 1 for the day. October bean meal futures, $2.71.20, down 1.50. December futures at $2.77.10, down 1.20 as well. October bean oil, 32 higher at $39.31. December futures, $39.83, up 31. October live cattle, $97.65, 95 higher. December futures up 60 at $100.77½. And the September feeders at the Mercantile Exchange, 116.15, down 25. October futures, 5 higher at $116.25, 100 weight. October lean hog, 61.52½, 17½ higher. December futures were down 47½ at 63.32½, and the Febs at 67.55 were down 55. Frozen bellies at $87.50, 80 cents higher on the afternoon. From the outside markets, November crude oil trading $80.90 at this hour, down 72. December futures off 64 at $80 even. The CRB index at 333.73, that's 58 higher. The Dow at 78.55, down 03 for the afternoon. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 13,777, is just about 42 points lower at this hour.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Joining us now to take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange is Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the trade over the weekend, what happened in your area and the clientele that you've been talking to as far as harvest goes, and where we're expected to go from here.
Well, as far as harvest goes, fairly active progress, extremely dry and bringing moisture content, maybe too low in some areas, actually. A lot of hope that there will be some rain here, not only give guys a break, but also to bring the moisture up just a tad bit on it. Central part, we're hearing yields still relatively strong. know, about 230, 220 bushels. But you don't have to venture very far, especially as you get into eastern Illinois, Indiana. You know, these yields drop off dramatically down to this 120, 160 bushel area. Bean yields a lot of 45 to 55 bushels. I've heard some upper 50s and some lower 40s, but a lot of it's 45 to 55 for, say, extremely dry, too, in the beans. We'll see how this progress goes here as we move through the week. This afternoon's harvest progress reports expecting to show corn harvest 25 to 30% complete. And the bean progress expected to be anywhere from 10 to 14% on it as we start to see a lot of progress take place in Iowa. Illinois is going to show some big jumps. Some guys are done in some areas, the southeast, too. Be interesting to see how far along we are there. Basically, the most interesting thing we saw today in the future side of the equation was the corn market opened steady but gave way to a little profit taken from the funds. Funds were sellers of about 4,000 contracts on the day. A little bit of hedge pressure, too, came into the marketplace. But once the corn market futures dropped to that 370 area, found some pretty aggressive buying. That point was sort of where we broke out to the upside, so we went back to the point of breakout, was able to bounce off of it. So as we go into the next few days of trade, I feel that pit brokers and analysts are going to watch this 371, 372 area, sort of a key level of support. If that fails, we could probably drop another 10 cents, Todd.
It's fairly amazing at this time of year, seasonally. This week and I think next week are considered the heart of the harvest season, usually a pretty tough downward movement in the marketplace. But a dime doesn't sound like a lot of losses under the pressure that, certainly under the corn pressure, that the market should be under at this point.
Yeah, that being said, mainly futures. We're speaking futures. Cash side might be a whole different story. There's some areas that's going to be heavily harvested and put a lot of heavy pressure on some elevator bids in some areas. So we feel most of the price risk over the next week or two, 3 weeks is probably going to be more so in the cash. We feel the futures market is going to be well supported on breaks, anticipation of this bidding for acres here this winter. Also, too, we're starting to see some end users come forward and try to gather some coverage. Big crop, but there's some huge demand. We saw that we sold another 200,000 tons of corn to unknown destination. China came in and bought 120,000 tons of beans. So we're in the glut of harvest. These end users, remember, last year corn rallied over a dollar during the harvest.
You know, I'm going to tick up beans just a bit because we're in that area now when we approach the top of the $9 level, building into $10, where farmers always are thinking, well, will we see 11? Might we see 12 at some point? But certainly will we see 11? Historically, that's not usually the case. What do you think producers should be doing with beans, given the real disparity there is between the cash market or the basis levels and what's been happening on futures at this time?
Well, wide basis has been a concern, you know, for some time, and we feel that's not going to go away anytime soon with the big amount of grain we have to handle here. The basis is probably going to stay wide, so if you're going to get bullish something once we get through harvest, we feel basis can come back in a hurry as we get halfway, three-quarters through harvest. This stuff starts to find a home. We feel the strongest point basis will be the first part of December. We feel that there's going to be some appreciation between sometime this fall until then. So if you're looking to look for narrow basis, we target that time window. As far as outright, you mentioned those lofty levels of prices on beans. When we go back in history, these are very good levels. We've made some recommendations to get caught up on bean sales, even though basis in wide some areas, we're still looking at some fairly attractive price levels. But we feel this is the area that maybe let a few beans go, may store a little corn. Our next level price target on beans, we're watching the $10 level in these Novembers. If Novembers were be able to move above $10, the next upside objective would be 10 and a half. But we feel we need to reward the market as we go, especially in this old crop, on beans especially, because when we talk to producers clear across Midwest, we pretty well agree we're going to buy a lot of bean acres. Producers have been in the mindset or mode here to find a reason to cut back and not pay higher input costs for corn and maybe go back to a little bit more of a rotation, which includes more beans in the rotation. So we feel we need to reward the market, Todd.
Reward the market, and you gave them a futures price at which to reward the market. I guess because of the wide basis and the wide variability in the basis, do you have a cash side that you would think that they ought to be aiming for? Is it the 915, 920, 925 on the cash side of the marketplace?
Well, it's hard to give a cash quote because cash quotes range anywhere from 939 to 860 clear across the whole sector here. So futures price level to keep everybody so they can watch something. November bean futures, the 1045 area would be the next target here to shoot for here over the next week or two.
Okay, and then what do you see in the outside markets from the crude oil potentially? What's been happening in the U.S. economy?
Well, the main thing on the outside markets, and it's been well advertised, is the U.S. dollar, the weakness in the U.S. dollar. That's enabled our exports to look more favorable on the world market, even with this price run-up. If you use sort of the yen corn chart and put the price of corn in yen, we're about 425 the cost of our corn in yen. That's down from a couple months ago when we were above the 475, pushing $5 level. But we're way below the historic highs back in the early 80s of $8.59. So our grain, even though high transportation costs and everybody trying to get their finger in on it, we're still relatively cheap in the world sector. So it makes our corn market very attractive, and we feel that's going to stimulate some demand here as we go into this fall. Crude oil is very interesting. We've had a fairly good run-up in through here. Crude oil's had the spotlight, but we feel the spotlight's probably on heating oil. When you go into this fall and through here, seasonally heating oil is the one that starts to price some weather premium in it. We're getting past the hurricane season, so the glamour is going to turn from weather in the Gulf to weather in the upper Midwest.
All right. We appreciate you being with us.
Very good.
That's Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report each and every Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Just after the bottom of the hour, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. And don't forget to stay with us through the second half hour of the 2 o'clock hour when we'll be joined by Ben Kaler, who is with Dow AgriSciences. He'll talk a little bit about Herculex. Ben is in charge of leading the group that licenses Herculex to hybrids across the globe. So we'll talk about Herculex with him, a little bit about SmartStax, the agreement with Monsanto that Dow just announced, and some other topics. We'll also take your phone calls. That all happens during the 2:30 to 3 o'clock Central time frame this afternoon. Here's what the forecast looks like from our own Ed Kieser this afternoon. He says in the western and southern part of Illinois for the two-state region, a mix of clouds and some sunshine, some scattered showers, a few thunderstorms will develop. Elsewhere to be mostly sunny and hot. Highs will range from 88 to 94. Tonight in Illinois, mostly cloudy, some scattered showers. Thunderstorms will be most numerous in the west. In Indiana, partly cloudy and mild, a chance of a few showers in western sections. That'll happen late in the evening and early morning hours. Lows will range from 67 to 72. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, some scattered showers and some thunderstorms, says Ed. They'll range from 72 in the far northwestern Illinois for the temps to around 90 in the southern part of Indiana. In a few moments, Dave Dickey will be here to take a complete look at today's agricultural newscast. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. This is WILL Urbana.
In agricultural news, Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Tom Harkin has scheduled the week of October 1st for markup of the farm bill. That leaves a period of about 6 weeks to move the bill through the full Senate and then a conference with the House before Congress breaks for the year. Meanwhile, House leadership says Congress cannot complete its work before an October 26 adjournment date and has pushed the start of the recess to November 16th. House and Senate Agriculture Committee leadership say they will not seek a short-term general extension of the 2002 Farm Bill when it expires this coming Sunday. However, extensions of programs that expire may have to be included in a continuing resolution to fund the government after September 30th. House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson says a full general extension is not needed, and in his words, "I don't want anybody to get into any kind of mode that we need an extension." The Senate is considering today a conference report for the Water Resources Development Act. The original Senate bill passed 91-4. Congress has not updated projects for WERDA since 2000. Farm Bureau officials say swift passage of a Peru free trade deal with the U.S. would be a boost for agriculture. Jonna Miller is with the AFBF, and she has this report.
If Congress would approve the Peru Free Trade Agreement, it would mean a hefty boost to the U.S. farm economy.
The total increase in U.S. farm exports associated with the Peru Agreement could exceed $705 million per year.
South Carolina Farm Bureau President David Winkles testified before the Senate Finance Committee about the Peru, Colombia, and Panama Free Trade Agreement's potential for improving U.S. farmers and ranchers' bottom lines.
These three agreements will make agricultural trade more equitable between the U.S. and these partner countries by making U.S. agricultural exports duty-free to their market, equivalent to the access they already have to the U.S. market.
Winkles urged the Senate to take action on these important trade agreements.
These three agreements provide gains across U.S. agriculture, and we estimate that passage of the Peru, Colombia, and Panama agreements will increase U.S. agricultural exports by almost $1.5 billion per year when the agreements are fully implemented.
Jonna Miller, Washington.
The chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee has introduced a bill that would mandate new user fees for imported food, limit ports for imported food to 13 in close proximity to FDA inspection sites, and require labeling for meat and poultry packaging utilizing reduced oxygen formats. Michigan Democrat John Dingell is holding a hearing on the measure on Wednesday. And a bipartisan group of Southern senators is asking the U.S. Trade Representative to reject major cuts in cotton subsidies that could come up in World Trade Organization talks. In a letter sent last week, the senators warned that treating cotton different from other U.S. subsidies would severely compromise support for presidential trade promotion authority in the future. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey, of course, your Director of Agricultural Programming here at the WILL radio stations. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week. Hey, do you want to know more about Herculex, possibly about 2,4-D-tolerant corn and soybeans, or the SmartStax deal that Dow AgroSciences has just pinned with Monsanto? Well, we've got your opportunity. Ben Kaler is the traits and germplasm licensing business leader on the Herculex insect protection business for Dow AgroSciences. He will join us and take your phone calls between about 2:36 and 3 o'clock Central Time this afternoon. Get those cell phones out now and ready to dial him up. Now up next, there's a tool farmers can use to compare delivery points, one elevator against another. We'll have more on the University of Illinois Grain Delivery Model Spreadsheet. One of the most frequent questions University of Illinois Farm Management Specialist Gary Schnittke says he gets from farmers is how to compare the cost of delivering grain to one elevator against another. That's why he and another colleague in the U of I's Agricultural College put together an Excel spreadsheet to do just that.
Actually, a number of farmers prompted it, and in particular those close to the Illinois River had the option of either going to the river or someplace else. So, But most farms have some option as far as where they deliver grain to. So it's come up actually pretty often in our discussions with farmers.
Often enough for Gary Schnitke to add a spreadsheet to calculate the differences between delivery points to the section of more than 25 downloadable Excel spreadsheets the U of I offers for free on its FarmDoc website.
It's an Excel spreadsheet. You have to download it. You have to have Microsoft Excel to run it. It's available from FarmDoc, www.farmdoc.uiuc.edu, and it's in the Fast Tools section there.
The costs considered in the grain delivery comparison model spreadsheet include transportation, drying, storage, and interest. All of the figures can be user-defined. The end result shows the net returns of delivering grain to the different locations. The grain delivery model is free for downloading from the U of I FarmDoc website. It is in the Fast Tools section and requires Microsoft Excel to operate. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
I'm Denise Perry, local host of All Things Considered. A day's pledges in 1 hour. Power Hour, 7 a.m., October 11th.
Time now for our Monday look at the cash grain market, and Wyatt Muse of the Andersons joins us. Good afternoon to you, Wyatt.
Afternoon, Todd.
Hey, the piles of grain as I come in town by the Andersons from my home sure are growing and growing swiftly. We've got one in the back, one in the front. How big are they at the moment?
Well, we're piling two at a time right now, and tally this morning was 1.5 million, and I'd say by the day's end tomorrow we'll be pushing that 2.0 mark.
And then you've got two more to go after those two are filled up?
One more we're counting on, and depending if this corn keeps coming in at the rate it has been, yeah, we would have another one coming in.
Any disappointing yields that you've heard over the past couple of weeks?
I can just say that the corn is better than expected, and we're all thankful for that.
How about the soybeans?
Soybeans are coming in, mixed reports. People expected a little bit lower than we had last year, just based on the moisture levels we had in August. But I would say that some people are happy with their beans. It's a mediocre bean yield year, and good thing is the price of beans are at levels much above a year ago.
How far through the season do you think producers in the immediate area might be? Are we halfway through?
I can't say that we're quite halfway. We may be pushing that on the corn in some areas, especially to the west, but I'd say maybe 40% range is probably more reasonable. And I think some people have been waiting on the beans to see if we're going to get a rain tomorrow. I know we have a 60% chance. And the strange thing about the beans this year is some of the stems are still green and the beans themselves are just very dry. The corn's drying down very fast also. Our average receipts coming in over the weekend were just over 15%, and some of it as low as 12% corn. So the corn's dried down very good. The beans are very, very dry, and a rain may be welcome to both for a break and to get some moisture back in the beans.
Seasonally, this is the time for serious pressure on the cash market. Have we seen it yet?
No. Actually, our basis here at the Andersons has improved a nickel over the last week, and we're trying to encourage as much grain coming in as possible, keeping our hours 7 to 7, and maybe this last 25% of harvest may pressure the basis once we get towards the end. I know some people have been shutting their doors and some of the processors are tightening up on their hours. But I would say logistically we're still doing okay. The bean harvest is starting to really ramp up and people are going to their bins. So once the bins are full, maybe that last little bit of harvest will start to pressure the basis, but we really haven't felt it yet.
And finally, your bids for the day?
Cash corn, 343. And cash beans, 939.
We appreciate it much. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Wyatt Muse with the Andersons joins us here on the Closing Market Report on Monday afternoon. Stay with us. We're not done yet. We have weather to come, and then we'll talk with Ben Kaler of Dow AgriSciences through the 3 o'clock hour. Right now, it's time for your regional newscast.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. Republican presidential candidate John McCain called it astonishing and astounding that Iran's president is in New York to speak at Columbia University. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad spoke at a university forum today and plans to follow it up with a scheduled address to the UN on Tuesday. McCain spoke in Chicago today during a fundraising trip to Illinois. He said Americans don't mind if the Iranian president came to the UN, but the Arizona Republican says Americans mind very much if he's given a forum to convey what he calls the policies of hate and destruction that would characterize Iran's behavior toward the U.S., particularly about Iraq. U.S. economic growth trended below average in August with little inflationary pressure over the coming year. That's according to data released today by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. The Chicago Fed National Activity Index dropped to negative 0.57 in August, the lowest mark for the index since January. The index is a weighted average of 85 indicators of national economic activity. A zero value for the index indicates that the national economy is expanding at its historic trend rate of growth. Negative values indicate below average growth. The president of Southern Illinois University says he's staying focused on doing his job and not on an ongoing review of plagiarism allegations. In a recent interview, President Glenn Pichard commented on the panel of professors that began its work last week. The group is reviewing his 1974 master's thesis and 1984 doctoral dissertation, trying to dig out claims that parts of both documents were plagiarized. Pichard says SIU has a procedure for looking into the allegations and making a determination about his status. The former congressman and candidate for Illinois governor has said he would not step down from his job. Purdue University says a test of an emergency messaging system was a success today. The university sent messages to nearly 10,000 students, faculty, and staff. Officials also sent out emails to more than 50,000 people. School officials say it took less than 7 minutes to send out the text messages. Within 10 minutes, 865 people responded to the emails and more than 2,000 responded to the texts. Officials now hope to look for any kinks in the system. The messages are part of an effort by Purdue and other schools to quickly notify students and others in an emergency after the April shootings at Virginia Tech. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
I'm Todd Gleason, AM 580 Agriculture. We're joined on this Monday afternoon by John Davis, meteorologist at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast for the two-state region, the Midwest, and the globe. Good afternoon to you, John.
Well, good afternoon, Todd.
How's the view from your 23rd floor?
23rd floor. Absolutely beautiful. Can almost see the champagne.
Well, you're facing the wrong way, aren't you?
We are, but I just thought I'd say it anyway.
Well, you can see. Maybe you can see to Sheboygan. So what do we got on tap for the weather for the next couple of days?
Well, the next couple of days, we are going to have some rain coming through as we go into starting tomorrow and on into a Wednesday. And that will be the first rain that much of the middle of the Midwest has had here for quite some time. But then after that, it's certainly not the start of any kind of a long-term stretch of wet weather. As we begin to get back into a drier pattern by late this week and into the start of the upcoming weekend. So the bottom line is that certainly some rain coming through, but also no sign of any kind of wet pattern developing across areas of the Midwest, and certainly nothing in the way of any kind of a real problems from a standpoint of delays in fieldwork operations.
And then if you look around the globe, what do you see?
Well, you know, we continue to have the hot spots around the globe that continue to cause problems. Australia wheat, obviously, is a huge problem, and that continues to have issues, especially in the southeast portion of Australia. We don't really see any change in that situation basically through the end of this month and into the very early portion of October, and their yields and their production potential for their wheat crop continues to go downhill. In South America, that it's a little bit too early for that to be a hot spot, but that will become an issue as we go into October and November. Dryness has raised some concerns as some people think about some early planting, especially down across Brazil. But it does look like we are going to get into a bit more of an active pattern over the next week or two. So some of these early dryness issues, if you will, looks like they'll be waning here over the next couple of weeks as a more active pattern does develop across the region. And the ridge of high pressure, which has been dominating that area, does tend to dissipate.
All right, and then is there anything else that we need to add about the Midwest over maybe the next 2 weeks?
Well, I think over the next 2 weeks, the warm weather pattern continues, not as warm as what we're seeing today. And again, today we're seeing some record-setting temperatures across areas of the Midwest. So we're going to moderate somewhat across areas of the belt, but the overall pattern of above-normal temperatures looks firmly entrenched across the Midwest over the next couple of weeks.
We appreciate you being with us.
Okay, Todd.
All right, that's John Davis of Chesapeake Peak Energy in Chicago, Illinois, joining us here on the Closing Market Report on this Monday afternoon. Make sure you stay with us for the Closing Market Report because it isn't over just yet. Through the 3 o'clock hour, Ben Kaler of Dow AgriSciences will join us, and we'll take your phone calls on everything from Dow's role in the global market for seed and herbicides to new GMO traits the company has planned for the next several years. It all comes up right here on this expanded edition of the Closing Market Report.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting music with a Latin twist with Fiestas and Fandangos on Thursday, October 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program will include works of guest composer Roberto Sierra and feature James Carter on saxophone and marks the world premiere of Sierra's Piano Concerto.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. It's an expanded edition. Ben Kaler is joining us this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Ben. We appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much, Todd. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you along. Ben is the traits and germplasm licensing business leader on the Herculex insect protection business. That is to say, he works specifically with the traits and business and the licensing of Herculex to seed companies. He's had some previous experience as well as a mycogen seed sales leader and a marketing specialist for corn herbicides. So he has a broad range of experiences with Dow AgriSciences. And we'll be taking your questions for him through the top of the hour on what Dow likes to call the Better BT, Smart Stacks, Dow's Global Reach, and new herbicide tolerance traits that are in the pipeline. If you'd like to make a phone call to us, you can do that at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455 or 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code. Locally, it's 333-9455. So let's, Ben, start with Smart Stacks. That's the most recent agreement you have, Dow has, with Monsanto. And we'll have 8 Stacks genes in corn fairly soon, I think.
Yeah, Todd, Dow AgriSciences and Monsanto recently came to agreement to stack their traits and our traits together to provide what we think is going to be a new level of traits in the marketplace to provide even better performance. It provides really some things as we look to the future that I think can remedy some of the problems. You know, one of the challenges for any new technology and trait is to keep it in the marketplace for a longer period of time to make sure growers have more opportunities to use it. And one of the concerns that we always have is in resistance management. So by stacking these traits together, we will have multiple BT strains that will be targeting these key pests. And especially in Illinois, where we know rootworm is a growing problem and it seems like it's getting worse, to have 2 rootworm traits attacking that particular pest we think is going to be very valuable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that because the in Urbana, we know that the University of Illinois research shows that YieldGuard and Herculex perform sometimes the same, sometimes differently. It sort of depends on which hybrid that it's put into as opposed to anything else. I suppose Herculex managed in a Pioneer brand to perform very well, but there was a mycogen brand in that study at the U of I that performed just about like YieldGuard. Can you tell me about the differences in the hybrids and how you might see that playing out across the Herculex line and the genetics you're going to put into the ground over the next several years?
Sure. We've tested the Herculex Extra for several seasons now, and performance on it has been very consistent and very outstanding. We had the one trial in Urbana where there was some variable results, but frankly, when you look at the performance over the rest of the University of Illinois trials and throughout the Midwest, it's very consistent, and we feel that it performs exceedingly well in controlling rootworms.
And that's true, but you're dealing with a different pest, as you mentioned. Once you get to the eastern part of Illinois and going to the west, you have a variant form of the western corn rootworm, do you not?
Sure. There's going to be the soybean variant as well as what we'd call the traditional corn rootworm. And even as you go into Iowa and Minnesota, they have what they call extended diapause, another variant of western corn rootworm. But irregardless of which kind of rootworm you have, whether it be the soybean variant, extended diapause, or your traditional rootworm, Herculex performs very well on controlling all of them.
Yeah, and then there are some things. Can you explain the difference between a Herculex BT and, for instance, a YieldGuard BT? I suspect producers know this, but there are some different, not the difference in terms of the way it controls western corn rootworm, but in the other insects that it controls.
Sure. Actually, there's a number of new traits coming on the marketplace, so it'd be very easy for growers to get somewhat confused in which trait controls which pests. You know, Herculex Extra is relatively new into the marketplace. Then Monsanto sells a trait package called YieldGuard VT3.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another, Syngenta brands sell AgriSure traits. And all of them do a very good job on controlling corn borer. All of them do a good job on rootworm, but that's really where the similarities end, as the Herculex family of traits also controls some other significant pests that Midwest growers fight, including western bean cutworm and black cutworm. So we do a very good job of protecting the plants from those two pests, whereas the other two trait families do not.
And black cutworm, most of our producers in the Sioux State region will be familiar with. The western bean cutworm, they will have only read about for the most part.
Yeah, western bean cutworm is one of those pests that seems to be moving rapidly across the Midwest. It actually started out as a dry bean pest in Colorado and Wyoming. And sometime in the 60s or 70s, it made the leap from dry beans to corn as its preferred crop. And back in those days, that's when there was still a lot of chemigation and aerial application of products to control corn borer across Nebraska. But as BT traits took over, there was fewer applications, and it kind of changed the habits of that pest. And so we've kind of watched it move across Nebraska, then moving across Iowa. And it's just now getting into kind of the western half of Illinois, where it could start causing some economic damage. So certainly it's one that growers want to keep their eye on in Illinois.
Listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon for about the next 17 minutes, we'll talk with Ben Kaler. He's with Dow AgriSciences. You can do that by calling these numbers, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, or locally, 217-333-9455, 333-9455. Just give us a call and we'll bring you into the conversation this afternoon. So let's go back just a bit to the SmartStax agreement with Monsanto. What is it that both companies are expecting to get out of an agreement that lasts just about a decade, I believe?
Yeah, in the SmartStax agreement with Monsanto, again, I think both companies looked at we could either be reactive to a potential resistance issue in the future, or we could be proactive and look at addressing it up front now. And we took the opportunity to be proactive. And by having the multiple strains of BT going after both the above and below ground pests, as well as having two herbicide tolerant traits, it really gives the grower a lot of flexibility in how they want to manage both their insect protection as well as weed control. In addition, we looked at, as growers continue to see the advantages of planting the corn rootworm tolerant corn, is there a way that we can work with the EPA to manage the refugia area differently? One of the things in the marketplace today in the cotton market is BT strains that use multiple BTs have actually had the refugia reduced down to 0% because by having the multiple strains out there, that's been proven to be a very effective resistance management tool. And so that's one of the other things that both Dow AgriSciences and Monsanto will look to do is put together the proper tests and provide the proper information to the EPA to see if there might be a way to reduce some of the refugia requirements that growers are faced with today.
So in the cotton, you've taken the refuge areas to 0%. With corn in these eight stacks, when you build in Liberty Link and Roundup resistance or glyphosate resistance, doesn't that mean that producers simply won't have a lot of choice about whether they put a refuge in or not, given the hybrids that they will be looking at and the herbicides that they will want to use?
Well, I think both companies see value in still providing some options. I mean, not every acre is going to need rootworm control. Not every acre is going to be using either a glyphosate product or a glufosinate product. So while we see adoption for it, we still think that there's going to be a market for a non-rootworm product. There's still going to be a market for acres that aren't looking to be Roundup ready. So I think that there will be options out there both on herbicides as well as insect traits available to the grower.
Can you tell me a little bit about the germplasm agreement that lasts for 10 years?
In the germplasm agreement, both Monsanto and Dow have agreed to share some of their germplasm so that each other can test the products and come up with some new and unique hybrids that could be brought into the marketplace. We feel that the germplasm agreement gives an opportunity to cross some products that haven't been done in the past, and you know, we'll see if we can't find a few diamonds out there that really help growers with their yield needs.
Can you tell me about Dow's global reach? And I guess I'm wondering, from an outsider's point of view, what it is that Monsanto hopes to gain, or what their benefit really is by partnering with Dow, other than Herculex. I get that. But what is it that they might get on the global front that they don't have, if anything?
Well, together, we will probably be able to work together to get the global regulation, the global registrations, which both companies feel very strongly about. So I think by working together, getting some of the foreign countries to approve these stacks will probably go quicker than if just one company was working on it. So I think the group working together can help expedite some of the registrations. The other value that Monsanto gets is the technology within Herculex really expands the insect control spectrum. And if you're going to put together a package of traits of eight herbicide and insect genes, you certainly want to have the maximum insect control spectrum. And frankly, that's what Herculex did.
What are the possible pitfalls of doing that?
Well, we first have to get all the products registered and get them into the marketplace. So there's going to be a bit of a timing delay. We don't anticipate that SmartStax will be available until 2010 due to the regulatory constraints and also making sure that all of the germplasm gets converted. So there's some potential risks out there. I mean, we may find that something doesn't perform, or a new pest shows up, or something else may come into the marketplace. But knowing what we know today, we feel pretty confident that that package will work well. And, frankly, there should be limited downsides.
Once again, listeners, if you'd like to join us, you can this afternoon. Toll free, it's 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can call us locally at 333-9455. If you've got questions for Ben Kaler of Dow AgriSciences, let's move on and talk just a little bit about herbicide tolerance. What's in the pipeline at this point over the next several years?
Well, actually, just recently, Todd, we had kind of our public unveiling of our next new herbicide-tolerant trait from Dow AgriSciences. We don't have a brand name on it, so just for an acronym, we're calling it Dow AgriSciences Herbicide Tolerance, or DHT. And at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, we had plots where we had corn that has already been converted to DHT, and then conventional corn that we sprayed with various high rates of both 2,4-D and with a grass herbicide that soybean grass herbicides that people typically would call the FOPs, or FOP herbicide family. When I had the opportunity to tour growers through the plots, and you'd ask those growers, how many of you have sprayed 2,4-D on your corn in the past? And virtually everybody in the tent would raise their hand, and when I say, how many of you can still spray 2,4-D on your corn over the top, very few people raise their hand. And I'd ask, so why did you stop spraying 2,4-D? And virtually everybody would bring up some form of crop tolerance concerns, whether it be brittleness in the stalks or brace root fusing, or, you know, it just makes the plants grow a little odd. So I said it wasn't because 2,4-D was too expensive, and everybody agreed, and it wasn't because it didn't control weeds, because it's very effective. It was the tolerance issue. So frankly, what our new DHT trait does is it fixes the tolerance in the plant. So we can spray high rates of 2,4-D over the top of corn from anywhere from pre-emerge all the way up to drop nozzle range without affecting the crop tolerance in the plant. And so that way growers can use 2,4-D, which is still a very effective herbicide, to control some of their troublesome broadleaf weeds. And it also will be very effective in helping control some of the weeds that are growing intolerance to glyphosate.
Ben, we'll continue this conversation. We do have a call on our line 4 from Effingham this afternoon. Do you have a question for or a comment for Ben Kaler this afternoon? Thanks for calling in.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
It's about weeds and resistance. What's the biochemistry behind why these weeds are developing that? I mean, we understand that bacteria develop resistance to antibiotics. But why do the weeds do this? And then I have a follow-up question.
Oh, sure. So I'll sort of put you on hold. So why is it, and I guess we should probably talk about glyphosate, why is it that Maristail and water hemp have been able to find in some populations resistance to glyphosate?
Well, I can give you the commercial description of that. There's probably a scientist that can give a far more detailed response. But typically when you see resistance into a chemistry, it's caused by repeated use. And, you know, you may spray a product, whether it be a herbicide or an insecticide, and get 99% control. Well, that 1% continues to live on, and over time it continues to reproduce and repopulate. And pretty soon, instead of 1% of the field that has escaped due to being either a mutant or just had a higher level of a defense mechanism within the plant, you have a field full of them. And so we've seen over time, you know, tolerance issues to atrazine, to the ALS chemistries. Now we're starting to see it in glyphosate. It's just that the weeds are able to adopt and become tolerant to these products, not unlike a lot of, you know, things that we've seen in nature over time. As they evolve, they become tougher, they kind of the tough survive, and that's what we see in these weeds as well. So,
so it's not
typically
that they mutate,
from usage, repeated usage, and just Mother Nature fighting back, and she usually wins the battles.
It's not that they mutate, but that it's some of the population is tolerant already? Both?
Well, some of them just have a little more built-in tolerance. I mean, dependent on the weed and depending on the crop and rates of products that are used, there may be, every plant has what I'll call a defense system, and some have more, some have less, and as they get more of this defense system, they're able to detoxify the chemistry better, and so they're able to withstand if certain low rates of products, or as it evolves over time, they're able to just adapt to the herbicide application.
And our caller has a second question. Go ahead.
Thank you. So you don't think that it's, or you're not aware at least, of the possibility that the fact that we've got Roundup-ready soybeans, that whatever chemistry was done to make that happen has escaped through the pollen, and these weeds are somehow incorporating that, and they're now Roundup-ready weeds?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any of that it's occurred.
Do you think it's possible?
Well, I mean, you typically don't see a lot of plants that are able to mix and mingle with each other. So unless the plants were receptive to soybean pollen, for instance, and it changed their whole morphology of the plant and appearance of the plant, it seems doubtful to me. Could it happen? That's probably a question for one of the University of Illinois scientists.
All right. Speaking of University of Illinois and soybeans, more of the soybeans, let's talk about the traits that might be coming in soybeans. I know our scientists here on campus are awfully concerned that there have not been new introductions of soybean herbicides. I don't know that you have anything in the way of new herbicide actions that are coming out, but you are building some tolerance into the soybeans as well?
Yeah, actually, Todd, we have both. We have new products that are coming into the soybean market as well as traits for the soybeans. First, we've established a whole platform of new chemistries called Technology for Traits, and it's herbicides specifically designed for herbicide-tolerant crops. In corn, we have a new herbicide called SureStart. It combines three active corn ingredients that's designed to provide residual both broadleaf and grass control in corn. So it's designed to start off with an application of SureStart, either pre-emerge or pre-plant incorporated. Then you would be able to spray just one application of glyphosate or glufosinate in the crop for a very good weed control. So it gives you that residual that you need, allows you to time your broadleaf or your glyphosate application more appropriately to provide very good weed control. And then in soybeans, we have a similar concept with a product called Sonic, and it combines two chemistries together to provide some residual grass and broadleaf control. So once again, you only need to make a single application of glyphosate in your Roundup Ready soybeans. So that's our herbicide platform that's coming from Dow AgriSciences. We also have a new trait coming into soybeans. And it's interesting that you bring up that question, Todd, as just last week I was in St. Louis with the American Soybean Association. They formed what they call the Biotech Working Group. And really what it is to work with soybean growers and export companies and grain growers associations to make sure that we're working cohesively together and collaborating on these new technologies to bring them to the market, but to also manage and follow the proper stewardship guidelines. So we met with the Biotech Working Group this last week of the Soybean Association. And whereas today we just have glyphosate tolerance in soybeans, coming shortly, there's going to be a number of new products. Pioneer has their GAT technology. Bayer is bringing out Liberty Link. And we're bringing out our soybean version of this DHT technology. So we're also going to have soybeans that will be able to withstand 2,4-D applications as well. So, you know, if you think about a platform, a chemical program in corn, if they started with SureStart and then came back over the top with glyphosate and 2,4-D, that would be a very effective program. Or in soybeans, starting out with Sonic and coming back with glyphosate and 2,4-D would be another very good way of controlling not only tough-to-control broadleaf weeds, but also those that are becoming more resistant to the glyphosate chemistries.
Ben, we thank you much, and our time is done for the day.
Very good. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you. You have a good afternoon. That's Ben Kaler. He is with Dow AgriSciences, where he handles the licensing traits of Herculex. Well, we sure appreciate you being along with us this afternoon for this expanded edition of the Closing Market Report. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the folks at the Eastern Illinois Food Bank on Wednesday. Don't forget that during the 10 o'clock hour of Focus 580, we'll take up ag policy. Bob Thompson will join us at that time. And then in the afternoon, we'll have Ralph Grassi on. He's with the American Farmland Trust. So we'll continue our conversation on Wednesday about the types of farm bill. We'll continue our conversation about ag policy and the farm bill that's now being debated in Washington, D.C. Actually, it'll be taken up by the Senate in full force next week.
PRI's The World takes you inside news wherever it's happening. You hear reports from our network of BBC correspondents around the globe. You meet people who are affected by the day's events. And we examine culture and controversy brewing overseas. Bring a global perspective to your day on The World.
Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Danville, Mahomet, Rantoul, and Tuscola, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.